Ah, yes. Nothing says holidays like this. Little Weird Al and Christmas at Ground Zero.
It's the most appropriate thing I could think of.
I haven't heard this in forever.
That's right.
That's
Don't
great.
You feel better now?
I do.
I do.
Thank you, Eric.
This is the truth, folks. So I always try to choose like an appropriate song, obviously. And I came in here, and it's been such a busy day at the store. And thank you to all of those lovely faces that we've seen in the shop over the past couple days. Look forward to seeing the rest of you over the next couple days. But yeah, I came in and ran in. I was like, I didn't pick a song. I need a Christmas song. Christmas at Ground Zero from Weird Al. Now, folks, I'm sure some of you at least are aware that I was a music major. I was a vocal major. I literally made money singing whatever people would pay me to sing. You can guess that I've sung one or two Christmas carols. I've sung every part of the Messiah that you could sing, from solos to whatever. I drew up, I was like, I don't know any Christmas songs except for one. And it was the one that came through for all of us. So there you go. Mom, Dad, sorry. Sorry about my completely misspent youth.
I believe we have Eric's segment for the Christmas Day show now.
There we go. Actually, in point of fact, and credit to my parents, actually, I think my mom got me that Weird Al album for Christmas when I was younger. So, hey, the circle is complete.
There you go.
It's there. So, yeah, before I launch, we've got a couple things, because as I'll remind you, this is my last live broadcast for this calendar year. We'll all be back in 2020, God willing, unless, of course, the song proves prophecy. This is the last one, because the boys are doing their Christmas specials and bests of and whatever, and that's great, because frankly next Tuesday I hope to be far, far, far too busy at the store to even think about doing any radio spots. But I did want to remind everybody that I know it's snowing, but green lights mean go. Especially to that one individual who seemed to forget that. And then got really annoyed with me when I laid on my horn after 10 seconds of waiting. 10 seconds, guys. That's not me being, you know, angry.
Were they on their phone?
I don't know. No. I don't know. It was a very odd thing. But that's okay. Anyway, I'm just reminding everybody, it's cool. I know it's snow. We all know how to do this. You can do it with me, alongside me. Unless you're in the car with me. And then I'll show you how to drive in the snow. Cool. So, as I mentioned, this is my last one. So, normally I do Christmas in the Holy Land sort of thing, wine in the Holy Land, and then also a bubble. So, we're just going to kind of cram it all into today and call it good, right? So, first thing I love to talk about, and this will sort of set the stage. Jancis Robinson, very, very, very famous master of wine writer, as she puts it, there may be dispute about where wine was originally made, but no doubt that the Middle East is the birthplace of the culture of drinking wine. Very true. So let's explore some of the lands in that sort of Middle Eastern part of the world that are sort of under constant strife, have been for millennia, but still is home to some of the absolute finest, not just vineyard land, but agricultural land. I mean, it's unbelievable. I mean, there's a reason that people fight over it. It's fertile, it's beautiful, it's wonderful. And yeah, it happens to be the seat to a couple of major religions. First, we're going to talk about the island of Cyprus, right? Cyprus, off the coast, there, sort of midway, between the northern and southern coasts of the Mediterranean. There's evidence of wine production in Cyprus going back to, 3500 BC, in the Middle Ages. It was acknowledged as producing the finest sweet wine in the world. It was a forerunner to the current wine Camandaria. It was never invaded by phylloxera. And currently, a strict quarantine exists for the island's vineyards, meaning a large amount of the island's vineyards are given over to native varietals, right? They didn't bring in other root stocks that could be contaminated or bad. So native varieties like the following, like Mavro. And Mavro, for anybody who, it's also in Greek, means dark, anyone's ever had Xenomavro, and also Hinisteri. And those are raisined to create the sweet wine, Camandaria, and can have, this wine can have up to as much as four times the amount of sugar as port. So it's an extraordinarily sweet wine, but what does that mean? As we've talked about before, sometimes sugar is an excellent aging agent. So Comandaria can age for a very, very long time. Most famously, this particular wine, Comandaria, was served at the marriage of Richard the Lionheart. And it was during the wedding that King Richard pronounced Comandaria the wine of kings and the king of wines.
Mm.
So there you go. Tiny little island. Don't really think about it much today in terms of wine production, but historically it's very, very, very important and has been for a long, long time. And very unique thing, just going back to that phylloxera thing, how quickly they realized what a gem it is to not have to deal with that and subsequently to impose a quarantine. I mean, that says a lot about a wine industry when you're saying no to Cabernet, you're saying no to Merlot, you're saying no to the things that frankly sell to the countries that buy wine, right? So it's a very, very interesting statement to make. Israel. Israel has actually seen a recent uptick in viticulture. It really wasn't doing a lot for a while. Currently, there's 5,500 hectares under vines. I'll remind you that a hectare is about 2.3 acres, so you can do the math. It exports most of the region's wines, mostly due to the need for the world having kosher wines. For years, the bulk of the wine was produced was sweet red for the kiddush, which is the blessing over the wine. And then what changed is in the 1970s, plantings on the Golan Heights and other high altitude sites, right? We've talked about that, of course, especially in South America, plantings very, very high up in the Andes Mountains here in the Golan Heights. And as I said, other high altitude sites really marked a change from bulk to, strain for the vine, better quality grapes, and hence better quality wine. So now you see a serious focus on good Israeli wine rather than just producing wines that are kosher for, celebratory purposes. You're finding Cab, you're finding Shiraz, Merlot, Chard, Sauvignon Blanc. In point of fact, in the latest Wine Spectator Top 100, one of the wines from the Domaine de Castel, which is the finest kosher wine I've ever had in my life, and a very, very good wine just to boot, was, I believe, wine 99 or 100 in the top 100 wines of the world. So, I mean, they're making good stuff over there. Sadly for us here, especially for some of my customers coming in now for the Jewish holidays, we don't have much in Maine. And for those looking for kosher wines, there's the Baron Herzog line, which is, they have a Chenin, they have a Sauvignon Blanc, they have a Merlot, they have a Cab, they're all right. We have a Malbec called Guillermo, which we think is probably the best of the bunch in Maine. So if you're looking for something like that, come on in and we'll show you what's available. Hopefully in the future that will change for the better. next, Lebanon, right? Records from 4500 BC, right? The Phoenicians. We've talked about the Phoenicians a little bit. There's sort of this really unknown group of folks that traveled all over the Mediterranean and perhaps further traders, subsequently spread not only knowledge of viticulture, but also genetics. And for those interested, National Geographic did a very, very interesting article a couple years back on who were the Phoenicians, and they traced them genetically throughout the rest of Europe. And it's really kind of neat. So yeah, the Phoenicians trading their wines and goods as far as Cadiz, right? So southern Spain. And further. So in Lebanon, in 1990, there were three producers. Three. Predominantly because there was a civil war that ripped it apart. And then obviously war with Israel and just permanent sort of strife. Now, by the end of 2012, there are more than 40, right?
Wow.
Most making very, very small amounts of wine. And of course, 40, there's not a county in California that doesn't have 40 wineries, but this it's tough. It's been very, very difficult, not only to produce wine, when there's tanks rolling through your vineyards, but also you got to have exporters. I mean, you've got to have people to come and do business, and that's just not the easiest thing in the world. Originally, there was a lot of interest in the Mediterranean grapes like Cab, Merlot, Syrah, but more recently, you're seeing interest for grapes typically found in drier and hotter areas, especially southern France's Languedoc region. So things like Sasso, Carignan, Grenache, Mourvèdre, Calédoc, which you don't see a lot in France, but it is a southern French wine. a great brother. We certainly carry the wines of Chateau Moussard, which is inarguably Lebanon's most famous winery. And for anybody looking for a good piece of wine history, check out Serge Hoshar, who is the guy who made Moussard famous. And you will indeed read about a guy, you know, trying to make wine while tanks were rolling through his vineyards and mortar shells were falling around the man. I mean, it's unbelievable. Very, very cool. And it really makes you appreciate what people go through in the Holy Land to try and just make a very traditional product. Yeah. So just food for thought. We have a couple more minutes, so I'm going to do my wrapping up the year bubbles bit. I did want to say before I launch in, thank you all for listening to this spot. It's always great when you come up to me and say, I'm a frequent listener and I learned this, or I heard about this. So it's very, very cool. Please always mention it and always say, hey, I'd love to hear you talk about this or talk about that. Next year we'll do it all again. And any new information that I have to give you on a very antique and wonderful product, I will give you new information as well as old information. So bubbles, right? A lot of people coming in right now for bubbles, both as gifts, and then of course we're going to be popping them for New Year's ourselves. Couple things to understand the styles, right? There's the one called Méthode Champenoise or Méthode Classicale, right? And that's a common two-stage fermentation process with the second stage that happens in the bottle. They add what we call a liqueur de tirage, which is basically sugar water, to start a secondary fermentation, and then seal it up, and they riddle it, which is that slight little turning that they do to let all the yeast and stuff follow to the bottom of the neck of the thing. They pop it, they get rid of all the yeast, top it off, and there you go. That's what's called disgorgement. Why is champagne so expensive? Because it's champagne. But that is an expensive process. So when you see bottles, Cava, for instance, a lot of sparkling wines from the rest of Europe, they're all done in that style. So it does cost a little bit more, but it's really interesting. There's also the Charmat method, which is used to make Prosecco. That's also two-stage, but the second stage happens in a huge pressurized vat, and it's then filtered and bottled under pressure. There's also the Méthode Ancestrale, which is the fermentation is stopped and then continued in the bottle, and there's no additional work done. And you're seeing things like Petillon Naturels, and we have a selection of those as well. And again, that's and you're going to see in the bottom of those bottles a little bit of yeast, because the fermentation happens in the bottle, it's stopped up, and the CO2 fermenting is what gives you those bubbles. They're trapped in the bottle and they'll come out. So lots of really cool stuff. We're running out of time, so I want to mention this Thursday, 5 to 7 p.m., we have a regular monthly tasting. We're going to have some awesome wines for the holiday, staff favorites. We're also going to be hosting Aegir's Den Meadery from Pittsfield, which are carbonated, sessionable meads made of, with stuff all from their farm. It's delicious, wonderful, and they're cool people. Come out and meet them. And we are open until the 24th for all your holiday needs. We are closing at 5 p.m. on the 24th, but we will open at 9 a.m. So come on into the store. We do gift certificates. We do everything you need. And if we don't do what you need, we'll figure out somebody who will to help you out, because it's that time of year. We all need a little help.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Big time. Hey, thanks everybody for listening. We'll see you in the store, and I will talk to you all next year here on Downtown.
Thank you very much, Eric. Merry Christmas. Cheers. Happy
Merry Christmas.
New Year.
Thank you. Thank you all.
You and Christine and the family. We got a little more Weird Al on the way out.
Beautiful.
Why not? What a way to wrap it. Back with hour two.
Sorry, we're drinking Laurent Perrier champagne, because why not?
Why not?
Cheers.
Indeed. Cheers.